sit at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Movement.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall. And I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression.
Expression,
expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
culture,
human rights,
charter dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings with my co-host Gord Barnes. Today we're joined by Ponziano Aluma, author of We're Here, Now What? A collection of stories about newcomers to Canada and their experiences. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Good to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
I really enjoyed reading the stories in your book. And I'm just wondering, what should we do first, Gord? Should we find out what your personal, sort of how you found your way here in the first place? And then we're going to ask you why you wrote the book.
Sure. How I came to be in Canada and Regina was that way back 27 years ago, in 1981 or so, I was a refugee in southern Sudan. Mm-hmm. I originally come from Uganda, so we fled to Sudan at the time when Idi Amin fell. And so I was in a refugee camp for 6 years. And at the time, I had just finished high school, but I had not gone to university. And with the refugee situation, the future was kind of bleak, and I wasn't really expecting to go any further with education.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an organization called the World University Service of Canada. They work with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and they identify students that are in that category who have finished high school but have not gone to university or have not finished their universities.
Mm-hmm.
And those students are not a high priority to UN.
Mm-hmm.
Because UN concerns itself first with food, shelter, and primary education.
Sure.
in times of emergency.
Mm-hmm.
So World University Service of Canada collects applications from students like that.
Mm-hmm.
And distribute those applications to universities across Canada. And my application landed here at the University of Regina. And for reasons that had to do with writing, people decided here to sponsor me. And at the university, they have what they call a group for refugees, comprising of some students and also professors that use their own personal money to put together and sponsor students, refugee students. Mm-hmm. And so I was picked, and I got a sponsorship from the university here. And in 1987, January 7th, I came to Canada and Regina, and in January 8th, I was in a classroom, and that's how I ended up being here.
Wow. I'm just curious what your English skills were like at that point. Did you do your studies in English, so English was not a problem, or...?
No, English was not a problem because Uganda is a British colony.
Right, okay.
And English is spoken in Uganda. Mm-hmm. Of course, my ears were not used to the fast speech, you know, in Canadian speech. Mm-hmm. I had to get them trained.
Right.
And my accent, as you can see, has not really totally, you know, come, you know, from what it used to be. But other than that, I had pretty good English skills when I got here, yes.
Right. So, like you say, just the ears. We have trouble sometimes if we go to the East Coast and listen to our friends in Newfoundland. It's a little hard understanding those folks, and they have trouble understanding us, too.
Exactly, exactly. Yep.
So, on to the book, then. When did you first think about writing the book, and what made you decide to take on the project?
The book first came up almost as a presentation. I was asked at work to make a presentation to staff about sensitivity, you know, training. Where we have employees that go and deal with increasingly newcomers, and sometimes they run into situations that they find difficult to believe because these stories seem to be, you know, out there, and so but they are real stories being told to people who have no point of reference to relate to these stories. Mm-hmm. So I wrote some of these stories, and then I made a presentation to staff at the CRA in Regina here on Employment Equity Day.
Right.
And the reception was very good, and I was asked to go and make a similar presentation in Winnipeg. And I did that as well. Again, the response was good. It was at that point that I realized there's value in this type of stories. Mm-hmm. But like most things, you put it on the shelf. You know, the idea of turning into a book really did not occur to me at that time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Until my wife and I decided we were going to adopt my sister's two orphan boys. And we ran against this reality that we didn't have the money. Even though they are family, to me, because of the international nature of the adoption, I have to follow the Hague Convention Protocol, which is to go through the Saskatchewan government here and do a home study, get approved to adopt my own family, and hire lawyers in Uganda to go through that process to verify that I'm not smuggling this case from there.
Right.
And in what it really means is that I have to pay a lot of money. Uh-huh. And I didn't have the money.
Right.
And so a friend... one of those who sponsored me at the university, then offered me this incredible deal, which is that I have this amount of donation I could make to you, but choose. Maybe if you choose to write the book, I can pay for the printing of it.
Right.
And so so what I did was I said, okay, I'll take that offer. And so I took the offer for her to pay for the printing, and then I wrote this book. And in the end, it became really something that seemed to attach a lot of people. And here we are. Yes.
What are the details? I'm just wondering, where are the children that you wish to bring over?
These are the children of my late sister. I actually raised her myself. And she was going to teach a training college in Uganda when she was diagnosed with mental illness.
Oh, dear.
And so she dropped out. And then she started wandering away from the family, and she would get lost for a period of time, and then people found her, bringing her back. During this time, So you was staying in Moyo, which is a small town in northern Uganda, close to Sudan border. It is an area where Joseph Kony used to operate, the rebel leader that was fighting the government of Uganda for many years, and who is right now still being hunted and is actually wanted in The Hague as a criminal. But the Ugandan government had managed to push Kony out of the country, but they also put a lot of soldiers around the border to prevent him from coming back. Now, what has happened is that my sister lived in an area which was teeming with soldiers. Even though she was mentally ill, as a young woman, she had a beautiful body. And so she got raped once, the first time in 2008, and she became pregnant with this first boy. And we also found out later on that she was infected with AIDS in that process, HIV. And the baby was born with a C-section, and the baby came out very okay. And from Canada here, with my colleagues, we were able to raise money and support my sister for 1 year so that the baby didn't have to take her breast milk because that would put the baby at risk. So we were able to save the baby that way. But 2 years later, in 2010, the scenario played itself again. And then there was the second baby. And so my family noticed that my sister's condition was not getting better. She was getting worse and worse. So in the end, they wanted to take her to the mental hospital. Hopefully she will get help there. Now, the mental hospital in Uganda was in Kampala. And my family was going taking this sister of mine from the north. It's like taking somebody from the Northwest Territories and taking them to Toronto. And they will not necessarily, you know, be familiar with, you know, the big city. But what happened was my sister escaped from the mental hospital, and then she was never found. We looked for her and we couldn't find her. So these boys are now, we presume my sister's dead, and these boys are now with my parents, and my dad is like 85, my mom is like 78 or somewhere there. They cannot really provide lasting future for these boys. So that's when my wife and I decided that we are going to step in and we'll take the responsibility to raise these boys. Then we find out we don't have the money to do it.
It there's quite a process involved in doing that, and it all costs money. So what you're hoping to do then here with the sale of your book to raise the money to accomplish this?
Yes. We have done a number of things when we first decided this. In June of 2013 was when we firmly settled on that we're going to do this. And so we raised, the first effort to raise money was we held a dinner at our church. And we were able to raise about $2,000 from there. And then we did garage sales in the summer 2013. We raised another $3,000 from garage sales. And then we held a steak night. We raised $1,500 there. So, and some donations. By the time 2013 came to a close, we had $9,500 that we raised. But these efforts are all, we were going around to, I mean, after our friends and family. And you can go so many times to the same people. And now people are going to start to avoid you. Here it comes again, you know. And so this idea of writing a book and it gives us a tool to be able to tap into a larger, you know, supporters. They get something valuable that they can enjoy in exchange for $10 that they give to us, which goes towards this effort. So we think it's a really good working formula. Now, my challenge has been how to get to those people out there who actually will be willing to support this course through this transaction. And that's where we are now today.
Well, you know, this book was actually recommended to me by my very good friend, Gail Bowen. And I understand from chatting with her that you've been quite successful in terms of selling your book. And maybe before we get too far along in the program, it's worth just letting people know how you're doing in terms of your book sales and where people can get a copy if they'd like.
Well, we have been very pleased with the first 600 copies that we printed. Right. And the first major effort was we did a book launch, which has passed. And then we have now a Facebook page where people can go and find information as to how to order this book. We also have some stores in Regina. There is a hair salon on 13th Avenue called Satori, mm-hmm. and we have copies of our book there. And we also have other store. I believe there is a another store on Dewdney. I forget the name. That plays guitar, you know.
Oh yeah,
yeah, Sachiwan or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have our books, and then there's a City Collateral, a pawn store on 11th Avenue by the police station. They have copies of our store. We have not been able to put it in a major bookstores like Chapters, although they express interest, but their commission is 45%.
Oh.
And so it takes us about $4 to pay for this, and then if I give another $4 away, and then I don't know how I'm going to raise the money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it has been a very challenging in that way. But mm-hmm. other than that, people can also phone me. Mm-hmm. My phone number is on Facebook, and my phone number is actually area code 306-533-8535. So anyone who wants the book can phone me directly, and mm-hmm. I can always arrange. I keep the book with me at my office. My wife always carries books with her in her handbag. And at our house, people come and pick the book. So these are places where you can go. And in Saskatoon, we have a one bookstore. I believe it's called The Tide.
Mm-hmm.
They have the book on the shelf there.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yes.
That's wonderful.
Well, maybe what we can do for our listeners who are tuning in today is when we share information about the program afterwards, we'll include the link to the Facebook page. And
yes.
That way it's easy for people to be able to find how to get hold of you and get a copy of the book.
Exactly.
It's a good read. How long did that little project of doing the writing take? Was it a fairly long process for you?
No, it was actually a very fast process because I was given this challenge in February when my friend decided that, you know, I can give you so much. You can decide to use it to pay the printing or use it as a donation. That was in February.
Right.
And so, and I said, no, I will take the chance to do the book. And so I started writing more stories in February.
Right.
And by March 31st, we had the book already printed and ready for launch.
That's great.
Yeah, so we were really going very fast, and I was happy to have people who were working around the clock editing the book, and Gail Bowen was one of the people that I would drop my manuscripts to her house. And she was here going to Toronto, so they got an appointment somewhere else, but she was able to actually, you know, make room to do this, and all the artists who had this, you know, book illustrated, they all came together as a community. Because it's like maybe someone will say, I don't have money to give you, but I have this talent I can put to use to advance this cause. And that's how this has all come together. And so it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, it's just great timing for us to be able to have you as a guest on the program, because just last week we marked World Refugee Day, as you know. And, you know, it's just so important for people to be able to hear an individual story like your own, that where you've shared already on the program, and we'll do some more in the second half of the program about your personal experience in terms mm-hmm. of having lived in a refugee camp and then later come to Canada as a young person and been able to study at the University of Regina. Mm-hmm. I know a number of the people who are involved with the University of Regina group that sponsors refugees, and that's been a long-term initiative of people who are really supportive in the community here in Regina, and I'm sure you're very grateful for the help you got through them initially.
Yes, I believe I remember one of the person who started that group, Dr. Jack Bourne.
Yes,
he has been very close to me, And he's some, I think, 96 years old,
yeah,
now, around
I
there.
Think so.
Yeah, but he's still got a very sharp mind,
yeah.
Very sharp mind.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm still in touch with a number of those people that most of them are actually, almost all of them are retired now.
Yeah.
But I've kept in touch with them, and they're doing a very, very valuable job.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So when you... You were in the refugee camp in South Sudan yourself,
yes,
as a young person. What were the circumstances like in that camp? Was it a large camp that you were in?
Yes. My camp was called Kala Refugee Camp.
Right.
And it was about 3,000 Ugandan refugees. But that was one of almost 30 such camps in southern Sudan around that time,
mm-hmm,
because with the fall of Idi Amin, the whole of West Nile of Uganda, which is the northern part of Uganda, had almost gone into exodus, and so they went to Sudan. So there were so many refugee camps dotting, you know, the other side of the border in Sudan. Life was very hard at first. You just, as refugees, you'll be placed in a forest, basically, to say you're given maybe a machete and maybe a hoe, and there you, among the trees and the grass, you basically set up your tent. You're given a tent,
mm-hmm,
and so people start from nothing. And UN will bring food and medicine and at the beginning, those were the basics, and eventually they build schools. Primary schools, and then they build a dispensary. Those are the basic things that UN normally concerns itself with initially, and after that, they can move on to something else, like, you know, they're getting post-secondary education for students or whatever. But initially, it was a hard life.
Yeah.
Yes.
And was the particular camp in yours, you were in, secure in the sense that was it? A situation where you weren't being attacked by the forces that you had to flee from while you were in the camp?
No, because the UN with the government of Sudan at the time,
yeah,
they made sure that their camps were put quite away from the border.
Mm-hmm.
So if any of those soldiers wanted to get to the refugees, they would have had to go inland in, mm-hmm, southern Sudan. And so that didn't happen. But there were some refugees who did not want to go to the camp, so they stay around the border so they could come back across the border at night to steal food from their own garden and things like that. So they took the risk of doing that. And some people got killed in that process, but the rest of us, we went to the camp instead.
I see.
Yeah.
So that whole process of actually escaping and getting to where you were, what was that like?
It was very hard because you couldn't carry very much.
Yeah.
You pretty much had to carry something that you can, you know, light.
Yeah.
And I remember I had these four sisters, and so we had a few that helped to kind of carry a few load with us. And my father, I remember, was very, later on he went back to Uganda. But when I was leaving Uganda, you know, of all things I carried a box of books.
Really?
Yeah, a box of books. Everybody else was carrying food. And my father was mad at me because you can't eat this food, these books, you know.
Yeah.
But I carried the books up to the refugee camp, you know, and that was my prize possession. Yeah.
And I bet you there were a lot of interest in the books in the camp as well.
Yes. In fact, it became initially the only library in that camp, because not very many people thought about books.
Mm.
This is the last thing you think about. It's like I was crazy, you know.
Yeah.
But it kind of talked about how much desire I still had in school at the time, and the war came, and I was rudely interrupted, you know, with my ambition to stay in school. But I still had this you know, sentiment about books that I carried books instead of food.
Right, right. It must have been a very, very difficult process in terms of, you know, the transition you had to go through with your family and moving. And we can share a little bit more about that in the next part of the program. But it's very interesting to have you on, and I really appreciate you taking the time to to share your experiences today. It's wonderful to have you
Thank
as a
you.
Guest.
Thank you.
I just thinking of all the guests that we have had on the program over the last few years who have spoken to the issue of what's going on in Sudan currently, you know, and there's been so much. I mean, when you were there, it was actually in an earlier point in time before the separation of South Sudan and from the North. But it's really been a very, very difficult time for so many people, not just the people from Uganda who were in South Sudan, but the Sudanese people themselves.
Yes, yes. And this is between Uganda and Sudan. Yeah. This going back and forth as refugees has been happening for years.
Right.
Yeah, we were refugees in Sudan. Before that, the Sudanese were refugees in Uganda.
Yeah.
And then they came back, and then they went back to Sudan. You got as refugees again. So, but I was there, and they suffered, and they continue to suffer actually in that place. Sometimes I think when we were refugees, even though we were refugees, we had a better condition than the indigenous Sudanese that were around us, which again introduced some conflict because UN had supported us and everybody else around us was fending for themselves, even though, you know, they were in their own land because of poverty. But with war, you can imagine how worse that has become over the years. So Sudan is one place. Southern Sudan is one place that needs a lot of help. It's a long way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's time now for our break. Time flies when you're having fun. And so we're going to do our break, and after our break, we're going to play some music. We always ask our guests if they have some favorite music that they would like to hear. And you have asked us for I Lift My Hands, Chris Tomlin.
Yes.
So we've got that all set to go.
Thank you.
So after the break, we'll hear from Chris Tomlin, and then we'll continue our discussion, talk some more about how you got the stories and some of the stories themselves. And they really illustrate, I think, a lot of the good things that happen in Saskatchewan.
Yes.
I believe. So
yes.
We'll be right back after this.
Than the sea, His mercy is unfailing. His arms a fortress for the weak. Let faith arise. Let faith arise. I lift my hands to believe.
Faithful God for faith arise. Let faith arise.
And that was Chris Tomlin, I Raise My Hands, and that was your selection.
Thank you. I really love that song, and it's one song my character in one of my books here is singing the six-legged snack story. That man loves to sing this song.
It's very, very nicely done, yes.
So if people are maybe just tuning in, we should perhaps mention again that our special guest today is Ponziano Aluma, who's written a really interesting book. It's called We're Here, What Now? And it's doing quite well in terms of sales. And we've been chatting about your own personal experience in terms of when you were in Uganda and had to leave as a refugee, and you were in a refugee camp. But perhaps we could maybe just go back to some of the discussion we were having over the break. You were saying about your nephews being in Uganda right now, and you're hoping to be able to help them come to Canada and so you can look after them here. But what is the current situation like in terms of stability in Uganda itself and daily life for people who are there? Is it a very difficult kind of existence for people in Uganda these days, or...?
Yes, Uganda has gone through over the years through lots of upheaval, mm-hmm. political upheaval, and there had been a lot of war. But the last 20, 30 years, much of Uganda, the rest of Uganda was stable, except the northern part where Joseph Kony had been operating. Mm-hmm. And those of us who are here in Canada may recall there was a video that had gone viral called Kony 2012. It depicted how this man had abducted young children from northern Uganda and then turned them to soldiers and raped young girls and all that. The area where he operated was where I come from mainly, in the northern part of Uganda. And so although the rest of Uganda was peaceful, the north was not. Mm. The peace dividend that the rest of Uganda received did not really accrue to the north, because all that time they were deprived, there was instability there, and the land was almost swamped by soldiers. So this is the environment in which my family is now staying. And although now Kony is out of Uganda and there is peace, there is still poverty. Poverty is still a big deal in Uganda because the northern part had been neglected for so long by the successive governments that had been in power. And so you find that infrastructure is very bad, schools are not doing very well, and poverty is quite rampant. And, mm-hmm. and that is the environment in which my nephews are living. So right now, my wife and I have to support my parents from here, basically. So my parents, with whom these children live, we are basically supporting them, you know, by every month sending money to support them. And so they are doing better in that way because of us. Mm-hmm. But really, it's a temporary arrangement for the children because they cannot, my parents cannot, because of their age, do stuff with them, cannot take them places, you know, play with them, or even get involved in their lives, will help them with their schoolwork, because they are too old for that. My father is, like I said, about 85. My mother is just about maybe 79 or something there. Okay. So, yeah.
And you were saying when you left Uganda as a refugee and went into the camp, did you have other family members that went with you at the time, or were you on your own?
No, I had family members with me. When I was crossing the border to go to Sudan, we went as a family. My father initially also went with us. My mother was with us. I had sisters older than me that were with us and their children as well. And we only carried what we could on our heads. I remember in those days, that time, I had the issues with my father because everybody else was carrying food because that was what was important. For me, I carried a box of books.
Right.
And so I crossed the border with a box of books. And it turned out to be the only library we ended up having in the whole refugee camp because everybody else thought about carrying food, which was eaten up on the way. But my books, you know, made it to the camp. But my father later on returned to Uganda because he couldn't really stay in Sudan because he took the view that the new government in Uganda was not a bad government. Everybody else took the opposite view, and so he became a misfit among his own people, and so it was not safe for him to stay in Sudan, so he went back to Uganda. And all of a sudden, I became the head of the family at the age 21
wow.
with my mother and
really?
My sisters and these young children that were with us. And so that was a very fast initiation for me, and it was kind of hard because I was myself just a young boy about 20 years old at the time. Yeah.
So did you have friends or family that ended up in Canada with you? Or in different places, either in Regina or in other places, from that particular camp?
Not from that particular camp, but we, at the University of Regina, at one time when I was here, there were a number of Ugandan refugees that ended up being at the University of Regina, sponsored in the same way I was sponsored. Some of them, I knew them from other camps because those people in the camps sort of traveled in between camps, so they knew each other sometimes. And some of them, I did not know them in Sudan, but I came and knew them here. But they were also product of the same upheaval. So we had a shared experience, shared, you know, understanding of what we had gone through. And we had a good, that maybe five of them together at the same time going to University of Regina at some point.
Mm.
Yes,
I guess that even, you know, connection with people was probably helpful to you initially when you were in Regina.
Yes, it was, because then I remember when I came, my roommate was from Uganda, and we kind of really supported each other because he was before me. So he helped me to sort of settle,
yeah.
But he also had some disability, and so he could not carry stuff and things like that. So in that case, I was able to kind of compensate for that. I would do the groceries and bring things home, and then we could take time to cook for each other instead of everybody one person cooking every day. So we kind of help each other that way, and it was good that way.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you've been here long enough that you got adjusted to our winters, or is it still a shock every time you get up in the morning in the wintertime and it's really, really cold?
Let me put it this way. I think I have learned to be like other Canadians, to tolerate the winter.
Yeah,
I don't believe I can say I'm used to it. You know, you just learn to cope better, dress better and anticipate better. And somewhat you can find something to do in winter so that you don't get too depressed, you know, and you become like everybody else. I no longer overdress like I used to do, you know, and I don't also lose my gloves, because I remember when I first came the first year, I lost I don't know how many pair of gloves, because when I entered the university building, you could stay inside for the whole day. And so you go from classroom to classroom to classroom. So I usually forgot my gloves the first classroom.
Right.
And then by the time I'm at the end of the day, then I didn't remember where my gloves were. And I had to kind of buy another pair. So I don't do that anymore.
I still have trouble with that one.
So do you ever get an opportunity to talk to people who are coming as refugees more recently in terms of what you went through, and sort of provide a bit of support to them?
Yes, I do. Actually, I'm quite closely involved in lives of some refugee families through the church that I attend, Well Springs Victory Church. I have a relationship with, for example, a family from Burma, the Karen family.
Really?
Yes, and one of the stories in the book actually is I got it from there, and I was involved in helping the children in the family to learn how to drive. Okay. So I will help them, take them around, and I because of my experience as a refugee, they seem to gravitate towards me because they sense that I understand them, and I have the patience.
Good.
I have the patience to work with them. And so I trained one guy, the son, and then the son, after that I trained the daughter to learn how to drive. And the son actually recently graduated from the high school, and a year ago he got admitted to SAIAS in Prince Albert.
Prince Albert. Yes.
And he didn't know how to go about finding a place there. So he asked me, so we traveled all the way to Prince Albert, yeah, and we sought for a place for him, and we find a place for him to stay. And so I remain very close to them up to today. So that's yes, great. I have been yeah, involved with a lot of that kind of situation. Our church actually is involved quite a bit with that, new people who come.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. The people who have come from that part of the world where you mentioned it's Burma, and the Karen people have really gone through some tough times before they got here too.
Yes, yes. My time with them, I remember one this friend of mine. He calls me his African brother.
Oh, nice.
And one of the things he tells me is that he likes it in Canada because there's no enemy for him in Canada.
Yeah.
Over there, even when he lies down to sleep, it's like he has to keep his one eye open because he doesn't know when an enemy is coming for him.
Wow.
Over here, he'd go and buy food and eat and sleep, and he doesn't have to worry about somebody coming to want to hurt him.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who have not been in those situations don't realize how appreciative new people, when they come here, they are, because of the peace that this country has. Over there, the people can come and rob you of your peace in your own house. Those who have got guns, they can do that. Over here, the police have to have a warrant to enter your house, so you can tell them that without a warrant you can't come to my house. Nobody over there can dare even think that way. Somebody's got a gun, you just have to kind of let them come in and do whatever they have to do. So, yeah, he's very, very appreciative. And a lot of people in that situation, when they come from that kind of situation and they're here, they're appreciative. A lot of people who are born and raised here don't realize it. They don't realize how good they have it. But people elsewhere who come here, they see the benefits of being here.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much they might have talked to you about this, but you're probably well aware it's one of the most heavily landmined areas of the world, in where the Karen people are, in terms of the government in Burma or Myanmar has really used a lot of landmines, and it's a real concern.
No, I wasn't aware of that, but I know that he said they used to always run from the forest. They spend much of their life in the forest.
Yeah.
It's like you couldn't come out. And so life was hard for them there.
So are there other stories that you'd like to share from the book in particular that you can sort of reflect on and with our listeners?
There are 11 different stories in the book, and these stories basically I obtained them from people that have been here, and they are all hilarious. All these stories have things in common. One is that the characters, they don't have enough information about how to go about a certain situation here. And what happens is they then use what they know from where they come from, how to go about it. And one story that I can cite here is there's a story in this book about milk. And one of us can say, what is so big deal about milk? But over the place this person has come from, Milk you bring, you usually drink it from the calabash. You know, it's open. You can see the milk, or it's in a gourd. You know, there's a whole hole, and you can pour the milk out in a cup, or you can drink from there. So this young man comes to Canada, to Regina, and he wants to drink milk, but the milk is in a carton, and there's no hole in this carton. How is he going to get this milk out? Every little boy, a little girl knows how to get milk out of a carton. You pop it open, and you know it is. You pour the milk out, but he didn't know that. And so what he does is he takes a steak knife and cuts a hole. He cuts a hole into the carton so as to pour this milk out and drink it. Those kind of struggles. New people come here and they go through it. Another example I had given. And it's written also about in the Leader Post was, where I come from, Uganda, if somebody asks you, let's go for lunch, that really means that they won't buy you lunch. But over here, let's go for lunch really means I won't hang out with you unless they explicitly says I'm going to buy you lunch. You can't assume they're going to buy you lunch. And so when I came in the University of Regina, a friend asked me to go for lunch. And at the university cafeteria, I didn't know the names of the food. I didn't know how, you know, what they were. So I was behind him with my tray and his tray. So he would take some food and put in his tray. I will follow his example. And we got to the till. He paid for his food and walked away to find a table. And I got there and I did at a till and I didn't have money with me. So I was stuck there with no money, with a tray full of food, because in my mind I was carrying this idea that he asked me for lunch, so right. He's going to pay.
Right.
And I was wrong. So it's just stories of that kind, which you can take the book, read it, and you enjoy, you can laugh about it, but at the same time, it helps you to appreciate what new people go through, mm-hmm. and your perception of new people becomes a little bit more gracious mm-hmm. because of this kind of stories. And that's my hope and my plan, is that as you buy this book, you help us to achieve our goal of raising the money to adopt my sister's orphan boys, mm-hmm. but you also get something to exchange and enjoy your story, yourself with it, and get a little bit of education about new people. And the people like me who have been here long enough, reading this story actually is like you get reminded of the path you walked, because after many years, you tend to forget at one point you were there. Mm-hmm. You know, these things were actually you. And now you have a chance to read it and you can laugh at yourself. You know, I can remember that. So this is really what the goal of this book is to be.
Well, what I really enjoyed about reading the book was how easily I could put myself in the place of that person.
Yes.
You know, not having the experience in a new place. I particularly smiled at the yellow car incident.
Yes.
Where after he's, you know, found out what a donut is,
yes.
and off he goes, and then another calamity strikes, and he discovers that the car that he bought really wasn't the car that he thought it was.
Yes.
And that could happen to anybody.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And it just happened to be the one thing added on to his other experiences.
Yes.
So it was really easy, I think, to put myself in the place of himself. I could see myself doing that very easily.
Yes.
So it was very, a really enjoyable group of stories.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it's been, as we were talking about, the book has been recommended by a pretty significant little list of people that are well known in our community, and it's doing quite well in terms of the sales, I understand, from what you were saying. I mentioned my good friend Gail Bowen recommended the book to me, but also I noticed somebody I just ran into this morning, Ted Gelada, is recommending and endorsing your book too.
Yes.
So there's some good reasons to pick this one up. And you were saying there's a Facebook page where people can go to find how to order a copy of the book. And for our listeners, we'll share that on the podcast later on, but maybe just share with our listeners right now, if you'd like, where people can get a copy of the book in terms of the Facebook page.
Yes, the Facebook page is called Help Kivuli Come to Canada. Kivuli is spelled K-I-V-U-L-I. And once you are there, under About, you can go under About, and there is information about how you can order the book. And there's a payment option there through PayPal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you can actually go and order the book through PayPal. And if you are in Regina, it is easy. We can just, you know, get the book into your hands one way or the other. If you're outside Regina, there's going to be mailing cost involved. And if you are, say, in another province, say in Toronto, I just had to spend another additional $5 to ship a copy of the book there. So I tell listeners to in the field, there's a field there for a button for donation. But you can press that, and as a donation amount, you can enter $15 if you are from outside Saskatchewan. Then we'll use that to pay the fees for PayPal and mm-hmm. also handling and shipping charges, and we'll get the book to you.
Great.
Yes.
Well, it's been great to have you on the program. A really interesting discussion, and I think I mentioned earlier, it's so timely when we've just had an opportunity to recognize World Refugee Day to be able to talk about some of your own personal experiences and also what you're trying to accomplish now.
Thank you.
And I think it's a bright spot in sort of the refugee story lately. You keep hearing about things are difficult, you know, in terms of the different agencies that you have to be in contact with, and you have to fill out the right forms, and it costs you money, and you always have to wait. Mm-hmm. It's the waiting, I think, that's yes. probably the worst, and hopefully that will improve.
Yes.
And thank you again for being here, and we've run out of time, so we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."